All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Today is May 13th, 2026. Yikes, baby. Yikes. Anybody see those PPI numbers that just came out a few moments ago? Well, you know the market did because the market is reacting very strongly to them. 6.0% producer price inflation. That is what was just reported. PPI doesn't get as much press as CPI or the consumer price index, right? That's consumer inflation. That's what we're all living with, or the other lesser known one, PCE. The Fed likes that one. I mean, CPI came in 3.8% yesterday. That was pretty high. All right. It's higher than it's been. It was higher than expected. Market wasn't crazy about it, but it didn't freak out. But PPI, which measures the inflation further upstream, this is what the producers are paying. That's important because if the producers' prices are going up this month, that means next month the consumers' prices are going to go up. That's how that works. The cost gets passed on to the consumer. And we just saw a huge jump to 6%, much higher than the 4.9 that was expected. I mean, guys, we've seen inflation prints come in higher than expected. We've seen, 3.7 was expected yesterday. We got 3.8. It was higher than expected. Sometimes 3.9. Oh, no. Twice, much higher than expected. I've never seen it beat by a full percent and change. In the years of doing this, I've never seen an inflation statistic come in 1.1% higher than the market was expecting, up from 4.3% last month. All right, we saw a 1.7% increase in producer price inflation. I mean, you can tell I'm hyperventilating a little bit. I'm probably going to get a little bit of calm down, Jack, decaf. I already switched to decaf. I mean, begrudgingly, this stuff is worthless. No effect. This is purely placebo here. I'm not running on caffeine this morning. I am running on angst over what producer price inflation just did. Month over month, 1.4% versus a 0.5% that was expected. Almost three times what they expected. That's up from 0.7 last month. Core PPI, this is important, strips out volatile food and energy. Core PPI came in at 5.2 versus 4.3 expected. So core was almost a full percent higher, and that's up from 4.0 last month, a 1.2% increase in core producer prices. And I was talking about this yesterday. At some point, we are going to see these higher oil prices bleed through from headline inflation into core inflation because everything touches energy one way or another. Everything is made in a factory or grown on a farm that's dependent on oil in the tractor or fertilizer or a factory running on electricity. And then the stuff is put on a truck and diesel gets it to the store, and the store has overhead costs and electrical costs and heating costs and cooling. All right. So energy touches everything. Higher energy prices eventually bleeds over into core. It has already happened in PPI. A huge jump in core PPI just happened, which means we're going to see a big jump in core CPI in subsequent months. This is the biggest jump in core PPI since March of 2022, or the biggest jump in PPI period since March of 2022. And of course, March of 2022, that was the last time inflation was just in full swing on the CPI end. It didn't peak until several months later. I think August or July of 2022 was the peak. Guys, I hope you like inflation, because that's what you're getting. That's what's coming here. Market is not happy with these results, nor should it. And that sound you hear is everybody's hopes of Fed rate cuts dying on the vine, because there's just, in my opinion, no chance the Fed cuts now between now and the end of the year, barring some kind of massive asset price collapse, which let's not rule that out. But barring that, I don't see any way the Fed cuts in the next few months. As all that's going on, we've got more India news. We talked earlier this week about India's prime minister was saying, don't buy gold, don't buy silver, which, again, I said this yesterday. If Donald Trump were to go on TV and say, don't buy gold, gold is terrible, even though I poop on a toilet made of gold, don't buy gold, I'm pretty sure the first thing I would freaking do is go out and buy gold. And, well, now not only has the Indian prime minister said don't buy gold, they just doubled the tariffs on gold and silver imports into the country from 7% to 15%. And let's do some back of the napkin math. 15%, say $1,400. That's a $700 tax per ounce on gold that they just put. They really don't want you buying gold in India right now. And that is to protect the rupee, which has been steadily collapsing for years. Oil imports got more expensive. They need more dollars. Gold is the second biggest import. Trying to get Indians to stop buying gold is like trying to get a zebra to stop wearing stripes. But at the same time, they need to preserve their dollars because they need more of them to buy oil. So this is currency protectionism going on. But again, telling people not to buy it pretty much means they're going to run out and buy it. Now, the oil situation continuing to get worse here. We've got global inventories, according to the International Energy Administration. Global oil inventories are falling by 4 million barrels a day. That's inclusive of the inventory that's being dumped from strategic petroleum reserves in the U.S. and Japan and Europe. 4 million barrels per day of supply deficit. That is the net result of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz minus the exports that are getting out through Western pipelines or ships sneaking out. And that's also after 2.5 million barrels per day of demand destruction that has already happened. So we're still wearing down the inventory. This is the calculus of the war of economic attrition between the U.S., Israel, and Iran. All right. Our inventories are burning down. At the same time, Iran's inventory is filling up. And if Iran's inventory fills up, they have to shut down their wells or shut in their wells, which is a very expensive, difficult to reverse process. We've got another story about Iran's oil inventory. In particular, on Karg Island is almost full. You can tell from aerial photographs, and a tanker hasn't loaded at Karg Island in 3 days. So the blockade is having its effect on both sides. The U.S. blockade is forcing the Iranians to fill up their storage. The Iranian blockade is forcing the West to burn down their inventory. Who blinks first? Well, that is the calculus. That is the question that's going on here. Also in the commodity space, wheat futures. Oh, we're back to 2022. They want their headlines back. Wheat futures were limit up yesterday after the U.S. Department of Agriculture released their annual WASDE report, that is World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. They release these reports, I believe, a couple of times a year. They do the WASDE reports, and they forecast the smallest wheat crop yield since 1972 due to drought conditions mostly, and wheat futures shot up. We're still a long way from where we were in 2022 when wheat farmers were like the Silicon Valley playboys for a couple of months there. But it looks like wheat is going to be heading higher for the foreseeable future here. And I'm sure these higher fertilizer prices aren't helping things at all, but this is primarily a drought story in the Southwest, not so much a fertilizer story. Again, that's just going to add to it. We've got Anthropic is in the news. They're in talks to raise $30 billion at a $900 billion valuation. And that right there, that $900 billion valuation, that is how Silicon Valley manufactures earnings. All right. Oh, I invested $10 billion in Anthropic at a $300 billion valuation. Now somebody else raises at a $900 billion or somebody else invests at $900 billion. Well, I just made $30 billion. Poof, it's like magic. That's how Silicon Valley has manufactured earnings. You think I'm kidding? Look at what Google did. I mean, most of Google's big jump in operating or in net income in their last quarter was driven by a markup in their valuation of Anthropic. And it looks like they're going to get another one if Anthropic raises at $900 billion. And I thought they were IPOing. Why are they doing another raise if they were about to IPO? Well, got to get those earnings up. And case in point, SoftBank just posted a $46 billion gain on their stake in OpenAI, which Masa-san had to pretty much sell a kidney in order to raise the money to do that. But, you know, somebody else paid even more for SoftBank. Therefore, I'm raising the valuation of my stake in SoftBank. And like magic, we've got earnings. We got a pretty funny story about Amazon employees here. Token maxing is the new thing where we grade employees not based on their productivity, but we grade employees based on their consumption of AI tokens. Because if you're using more AI, you must be doing something awesome, right? Right? Yeah. Well, apparently Amazon employees are casually admitting to using AI unnecessarily on unimportant tasks just to inflate their consumption statistics because that's the incentive structure at the company. And so, yeah, the demand is insane, even though the demand is literally their own employees wasting resources using their product because it's been handed down from some schmuck who fumu'd his way to the top, and now everybody's got to please him by saying, oh, token consumption is up. Ah, that's a straight shooter with upper management written right on his name there. Oh, and last but not least, we got to send a shout out to a friend of the channel who did something pretty amazing, and, well, he went through hell doing it. So stick around to the end of the show. Got a little bit of a – I don't know if you'd call it a feel-good story. I think it's a feel-good story. But, yeah, he deserves some credit for that one. So we'll stick around to the end for that. In the meantime, why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance today. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day. And the S&P futures are barely lower now. They were higher. They were higher by a decent clip this morning. Of course, then PPI came in at 8:30 and everybody said, oh, no, inflation's coming back. And stocks started to sell off on that news. 2 points lower, 0.03% in the red. The Dow down 234 points or 0.47%. Again, a lot of that coming in the immediate aftermath of that PPI release. And the NASDAQ is still clinging to positive territory, up by 73 points or about 0.25%. The NASDAQ appears to be doing pretty well because all these tech CEOs are on a plane with Donald Trump headed over to China to meet with Xi Jinping. Again, the NASDAQ, barring catastrophe, stocks go up. We'll see if these gains in the NASDAQ hold this morning here. I'm sure that Anthropic valuation story is also helping. But again, not nearly as high as we were after that PPI story came out. We saw it give up a lot of those gains. Looking over at the DXY, the dollar is higher this morning, 27 basis points higher at 98.56. And, well, we're about 0.25% higher here. Hold on a second. Let me just verify something. Okay, yeah. Yeah, we are 0.25% higher here. I think this is probably being driven by estimates of Fed rate cuts. And Fed rate hikes. Let's just check in on the CME's Fed Watch tool here, shall we? Right now, the odds of a rate cut through the end of the year are down to just 1.5%. There's only a 1.5% chance, this is based on interest rate futures, that we get any cuts. Again, it's virtually gone, any chances of a rate cut. Now, a 61% chance that the Fed does nothing through the rest of the year, a 31, almost 32% chance that they hike once, and a 5% chance they hike twice. Well, look, we've even got three hikes making a very small appearance on the chart here. Hawkish Fed is coming back, guys. That Warsh trade that Kevin Warsh is going to come in and just cut because Donald Trump wants it, it ain't happening. Not according to CME rate futures. Stronger dollar this morning. And we've got interest rates are marginally higher here. 30-year yield, 5.036. That's up by almost a basis point. The 10-year's at 4.47, up by a half a point. That's the highest we've seen in quite a while. The 2-year yield at 3.996 is unchanged, and the 1-month is at 3.660, down a fraction of a point here. By the way, looking at a chart of the U.S. 10-year yield, this is important. We highlighted this cup and handle pattern earlier yesterday, and I also want to point out that we are now a few points higher. We actually went as high as 4.48 this morning. We've given up one of those points, but we're pretty much matching the high that we got before the ceasefire was announced at the end of March, before Barak Ravid's anonymously sourced article about how, oh yeah, peace in our time and all that stuff. Well, we're back to those levels and we'll see. Are we going to get some kind of jawboning about peace talks now because of this one? Also, interesting development. We've got Fed data suggests Japan sold U.S. debt amid intervention. We talked last week about the yen-tervention, about how the Japanese government and the BOJ were supporting the yen by selling dollars. Well, apparently they got at least some of those dollars by selling U.S. government debt. And that's important because that's going to drive interest rates higher. The Federal Reserve's custody holdings of treasuries fell for the first time in a month at a time Japan was likely intervening to support its currency, with market participants debating whether the nation offloaded U.S. securities to fund its yen purchases. They almost certainly did. The amount of marketable U.S. Treasury securities the Fed holds for foreign official and international accounts slipped by $8.7 billion to $2.73 trillion for the week ended May 6th. That's according to data released by the central bank. Japan's Ministry of Finance was estimated to have spent about $54.7 billion to buy its currency during the same period. The drop in the Fed's holdings is consistent with the possibility that Japan's intervention involved treasury sales. Any decline in Japan's treasury stockpile may put further upward pressure on U.S. yields, which are already being driven higher by surging oil prices and concern the Iran war will widen America's fiscal deficit. Japan is the largest foreign holder of U.S. government debt, and supporting a deeply liquid currency such as the yen typically requires billions of dollars of intervention. So the Japanese dumped a small amount, $8.5 billion relative to Japan. I think they hold like $1.4 trillion or something like that in U.S. government treasuries. So it was a small amount, but still, they're selling U.S. government debt in order to defend their currency. That's going to put some upward pressure, at least temporarily, on U.S. interest rates. Looking over at Bitcoin, we're still hovering just above 80,000 here, but just barely, 80,229, down about 250 bucks. I would imagine Bitcoin also did not like that PPI print, but still holding above that important psychological level of 80,000. Looking over at the commodities board, we've got spot gold is down about 27 bucks here at 46.87. That's off by about 0.6%. Gold doesn't like the stronger dollar, and gold doesn't like the higher interest rates. That's probably why we're getting red in gold here, even though you'd think higher inflation means, oh, go out and buy gold to protect yourself from inflation. But higher inflation also means higher interest rates, which gold really doesn't like that. Now, spot silver is still clinging to some gains here, up by 10 cents this morning, $86.68, or 0.1% higher. We'll take a look at the silver chart in just a minute. But first, we got to do copper, up another 1.8% this morning. Platinum is up another 1.14%. Palladium is up 1%. Crude oil is actually pretty much unchanged here, down about a nickel, $102.10 for June WTI futures. Take a look at the oil futures chart here. Again, we're still holding above the 50-day moving average, just above 100 bucks. I suspect we're going to continue moving higher here. All right, but first, let's talk about what just happened. This just happened. This is on Trading Economics, United States producer price change. Guys, 6% up from 4.3. And again, the market was only expecting 4.9. Again, words kind of fail me here, and I know I was kind of hyperventilating about this in the monologue here. This is a huge miss to the upside for producer price inflation. This means get ready for sharply higher consumer prices, at least as shown by the CPI. Most of you are probably like, Jack, this is old news. I'm already paying for this at the supermarket or at the gas pump. I get it. But when the market sees it reflected in the data, the market reacts. And you're seeing that this morning. Producer prices in the United States increased 6% in April over the same month from the previous year. Producer prices, okay, that's talking about the average. Now, let's take a look at a 10-year chart of PPI. And this is kind of important because, right, this was the big inflation at the beginning of the decade, right? And inflation peaked, CPI peaked in July or August of 2022, which would be right around here. But now this is the biggest jump that we have seen since in a while, right? Now, it's not the highest level we've seen in a while, but it was one of the biggest increases we've seen in a while. Let's just take this one, for example, from Mike Zicardi on X, the biggest month-over-month PPI jump since March of 2022, the second largest in the last 10 years. And this is showing the month-over-month increases. And only once in the last 10 years have we seen a bigger month-over-month increase. Again, March of 2022, that was the peak. Let's take a look at that month-over-month number there. You can see 1.4% up from 0.7 and just sharply higher than the 0.5 the market was expecting. They were really caught off guard by such a big increase. Some increase was priced in, but nowhere near what we saw. And then core, this is big. Core producer prices increased 5.2% for producers in April, up from 4% in March. And this is important because this takes out food and energy. When you take energy out, you're still seeing the average cost of producing things go up 5.2%. which means the energy inflation is already starting to bleed out into core categories. Now, I'm sure tariffs is playing a role here as well, but tariffs isn't exactly new. There's been some changes to tariffs in the last few months since the court decision and the different statutes were used, But what changed in March that all of a sudden we get this big jump in April? Obviously, it was the Iran war. So energy inflation is already bleeding over into core PPI, which means it will bleed over into higher core CPI very soon here. And on a month-over-month basis, you can see it as well. Core producer prices month-over-month increased by a full 1% in just the last month. That is up from 0.2 in March. Guys, this was not good. This is a not good PPI. This isn't good for anybody. This sucks. All right, and what's driving it is oil, obviously. So let's talk a little bit about oil. Oil inventories falling at record pace on Iran war, the IEA says. Oil inventories are falling around the world at a record pace and will continue to drop for months as the disruption to Middle East supplies from the Iran war intensifies. That's according to the International Energy Agency. Global observed oil inventories declined at a rate of about 4 million barrels a day in March and April, according to a monthly report from the agency, which is coordinating the release of emergency fuel stocks by major economies like the U.S., Japan, and Germany. The market will remain severely undersupplied until October, even if the conflict ends next month. And I really doubt the conflict will end next month. I mean, the conflict has been ending any day now for the last month and a half, and yet it's still going on. The hit to exports is deepening as the conflict continues to effectively shutter the Strait of Hormuz, which connects the Persian Gulf with international markets. The crisis is also taking a deeper toll on demand, prompting the agency to slash projections for a third month since the conflict began. World oil consumption is set to plunge by 2.45 million barrels per day this quarter, the steepest drop since the 2020 COVID pandemic, as product flows are cut off and prices soar. So we are starting to see some demand destruction here, 2.45 million barrels, but inventories are still falling by 4 million barrels a day, which means prices are going to go higher, and you're going to get more demand destruction. And when you hear demand destruction, think life getting harder. Life sucks more for poor people because demand destruction is using less energy. And, well, everything in life uses energy. So if you're using less energy, it means you're living less probably. So we are seeing some adapting going on, 2.45 million barrels per day, but not nearly enough. We're still seeing 4 million barrels a day in inventory declines. All right, so that is the harm the Iranians are inflicting on the world to try to win the war. Now let's talk about the harm the U.S. is inflicting on the Iranians to try to bring about an end to the war. Iran's Karg Island oil shipments show first prolonged halt since the start of the war. Oil shipments from Iran's main export terminal appear to have come to a standstill over the past several days, according to satellite images, the first sign of a prolonged halt since the start of the war. The blockade is taking its toll here. There were no ocean-going oil tankers observed at Karg Island on May 8th, 9th, or 11th. European satellite imagery compiled by Bloomberg shows. While there have been individual days when the jetties have been empty since the conflict began, this is by far the longest stretch when no tankers have been spotted. Iran has loaded cargoes at the facility throughout the conflict, continuing to fill ships and use them as floating storage after their passage out of the Persian Gulf was blocked by the U.S. Navy. If Karg Island were to remain idle, it would increase the pressure on the country's remaining storage facilities, which satellite images show are filling up. Estimates vary for how much space Iran has left, but if all tanks were to reach capacity, it could be forced to make deeper production cuts. The country has already curbed some output. So you can see here, this is the Karg Island activity on each day, the number of tankers that filled up. You had one tanker on March 1st, one on March 2nd, none on March 3rd. But we average between zero and three tankers a day filling up in Karg Island. But then all of a sudden, 8th, 9th, and 11th, we had no tankers filled up for three consecutive days here, where we've only ever had isolated days in the past of no tankers showing up. So the blockade is taking its toll. The tankers are full, and new tankers can't get in. And so where are they going to send all that oil? They got to send it somewhere, or they got to shut down production. So that's the calculus. Who blinks first? The U.S. from the dwindling stockpiles and the higher prices and the higher inflation, which we just saw in PPI, or Iran, who has nowhere to pump their oil to, which means they have to shut it down, which is the lifeblood of their economy. That's the calculus here. All right, that other commodity story, wheat limit up as USDA slashes crop, corn, and soybeans see surprises. Both classes of winter wheat ended limit up on the day as USDA shocked the market with their aggressive production cuts in the May WASDE, according to Arlen Sutterman, chief commodities economist at StoneX. Wheat limit up as USDA slashes production. Both classes of winter wheat ended limit up on the day as USDA shocked the market with their aggressive production cuts in the May WASDE report, according to Arlen Sutterman, chief economies expert at StoneX. USDA lowered wheat yield by 5.8 bushels per acre to 47.5 bushels, a big drop in the expected yields here. And they lowered all wheat production to just 1.561 billion bushels, which is below last year by 424 million bushels and the smallest crop since 1972. There's a lot more of us than there was in 1972. That's not good. That is food getting a hell of a lot more expensive in the future, folks. Total winter wheat production was pegged at 1.048 billion bushels, down 25% from last year, drugged down by a 36% cut to the hard red winter wheat crop. He thinks production could be cut even further in the future. I think we've seen quite a bit of deterioration here over the last couple of weeks. These are May 1st numbers, so we may see a little bit lower number. Industry tours this week starts and should give us a bigger idea on the data. And guys, the reason for this is drought that is driving this. You've got the fertilizer thing is going to make other row crops more expensive, but the drought down south is just killing the winter wheat harvest here. And look, wheat futures, big jump up yesterday. You see that big green candle? That was limit up. There's these artificial limits. Once you hit that level, they shut down trading for the day. See you tomorrow. Better luck next time. Right now, it's down a little bit from that level, but 678, I think this is U.S. dollars per ton. Don't quote me on the measurement, but you can see the move here. Wheat prices have been moving higher pretty much since the start of the year. Now, let's zoom out on this because the last time wheat prices went vertical was 2022 and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So let's not get too excited, right? In the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we peaked at like $1,300 per ton. We're currently at $678. But this is the highest level here that we've seen since 2024. We were very briefly at this level, but nowhere near that $1,300 top that we saw in February, March of 2022 following the Russian invasion. So I think price is probably heading higher here. Are we going to get near those 2022 levels? I don't think so, but that one's worth keeping an eye on. All right, now let's talk about the shiny. India more than doubles gold-silver tariffs to defend the rupee. Again, when the politicians say don't buy gold, what should you do? Well, India raised import tariffs on gold and silver in an attempt to defend its currency as the country races to shore up foreign exchange reserves and limit the damage from the war in the Middle East. The government more than doubled import taxes on gold and silver to about 15% from 6%, according to two official orders, imposing a 10% basic customs duty alongside a 5% agriculture, infrastructure, and development levy. The hikes, which aim to cut demand in the world's second largest bullion market, follow a rare weekend appeal from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. He urged citizens to forego gold purchases as well as unnecessary foreign travel in order to help hold up the currency. India is the world's third largest oil importer. They've been hit hard by the inflationary shock caused by energy disruptions in the Persian Gulf. Gold is deeply ingrained in Indian culture and plays a vital role in savings, weddings, and religious festivals. India meets almost all of its demand through imports, with 710 tons of gold coming in last year. The precious metal has more than doubled in value over the past couple of years, although had dipped since the outbreak of the Iran war on inflation fears. So they are doubling the tariffs. And again, a 15% tariff on gold, that's like a $700 tariff up from $300 per ounce of gold. They're serious about this. So let's take a look at some of the charts here. First of all, gold, some resistance here, all right? You notice gold failed to recapture the 50-day moving average. That was back in mid-April, and right now we're still holding below the 50-day moving average. So the gold chart does appear to be biased to the downside here, all right? So watch that 50-day level, which right now puts us at around 46.87 would be the 50-day moving average. A close above that would be very bullish. Now let's take a look at silver, because silver has broken out above its 50-day moving average in just the last couple of days. We lost that level back in the, I think that was March. Then we very briefly climbed above that level in mid-April before breaking down below. But silver chart looks great here. I'm watching this level around 92 and change. That was the level from that dead cat bounce following the brutal sell-off in January. We failed to break out above that level about a month later. So low 90s is going to be an important threshold. And we're coming up on that level here, sitting in the mid-80s, or we'll say the high 80s now. But also incredibly bullish for silver. Take a look at the gold to silver ratio. Now, this is interesting. When silver had its monster rally last fall, we watched the gold to silver ratio break down below 65, which is pretty much the historical average over the course of my life. And we went as low, we went all the way down to 43 on the gold to silver ratio, where it takes 43 ounces of silver to equal the value of an ounce of gold. And, you know, that's down from, we went as high as 105 earlier last year. And that's when me and Bob Coleman were just pounding the table on silver, saying at 100, over 100, there's no way the gold to silver ratio stayed that high. And it didn't, of course. Then we had the big sell-off in January. The gold to silver ratio came back above that 65 threshold, had a couple attempts to break above that and failed. Again, that's when you see the gold to silver ratio moving higher, that would be gold outperforming silver. But now we have broken down again. The gold to silver ratio is heading south in a hurry. And it looks like we're heading back down to challenge those mid-40s levels here, which would suggest silver to outperform gold in the short term. I want to see gold recapture its 50-day moving average before I get excited about both here. But gold recapturing that level and moving higher would suggest both are going to continue higher, and then silver can outperforming gold on top of that. Suffice it to say, guys, I really like the shiny. Some signs of life in the metals market. All right, now we got to talk about the AI bubble. Anthropic is in talks to raise $30 billion at a $900 billion valuation. I mean, that's the whole story right there. There's almost no other details in here, but understand this increasing the valuation by doing these capital raises. This is how big tech manufactures earnings, because Amazon and Google in particular own massive stakes in Anthropic. And, you know, they talk about it all the way at the bottom of the article here. Google committed to invest $10 billion in Anthropic at a $350 billion valuation. So what happens to that $10 billion investment if Anthropic goes and raises at $900 billion? Well, it almost triples. Poof, there's $20 billion of earnings for Google. And that's exactly what happened on Google's last earnings release. At the same time, we've got Amazon. They're investing $5 billion in Anthropic at a $350 billion valuation, with plans to inject $20 billion more. What happens to that stake if Anthropic raises money at $900 billion? Well, that almost triples too. So poof, billions of dollars in earnings for Amazon. This is how the movement of money back and forth between the same companies causes this fake bubble to inflate by increasing these marks over and over again. And at the end of the day, what's supporting it all? Anthropic, a company that loses money hand over fist. The only one who loses money faster is OpenAI, and they're an even bigger joke. I get it. Anthropic's coding tools are great. The software developers see fit to remind me that every time I post anything about AI on Twitter. But the company loses money, and it's not even close. They lose so much money. But they just keep increasing the valuation, and every time they do it, big tech's earnings get bigger because of adjustments to the accounting. And that's exactly what happened with SoftBank in their latest earnings. SoftBank posts a $46 billion gain at the Vision Fund, driven mainly by their massive OpenAI bet. Well, OpenAI raised money at a $1 trillion valuation, so we're just going to give ourselves $46 billion from the stake of OpenAI that we bought at a lower valuation. Never mind the fact that SoftBank has leveraged up to their eyeballs, taken out debt, borrowed against everything they possibly can. Masa sold a kidney, and probably donating blood to buy more stakes in OpenAI. But on paper, it looks great because we're just artificially marking up the value of OpenAI. All I'll say is I can't wait to see the S1 filings from both of these companies when they open up their books and show the world just what a hot mess they are in the accounting space. But until then, we're just going to keep artificially inflating our earnings. And we artificially inflate our earnings by artificially inflating the demand for our product. Take this one from yesterday in Tom's Hardware. And man, was I having fun with this one yesterday. Amazon employees admit to using AI unnecessarily to pump up internal usage scores, and workers complain of intense pressure to use AI tools. Employees at Amazon, Meta, and Microsoft have also been gaming AI usage metrics. Oh, but the demand is insane, says the directors who are forcing their people at gunpoint to use their product. Amazon is the latest hyperscaler where employees have been caught inflating AI token consumption to hit internal usage targets following similar behavior documented at Meta and Microsoft last month, the Financial Times reports. The company set targets requiring more than 80% of its developers to use AI tools each week and track consumption on internal leaderboards. So they had scoreboards with your name and lights. Oh, Jack burns the most tokens because he's the best engineer at the company. What is Jack using his tokens for? A mouse wiggler while he plays games on his phone. Oh, but that's all right. He's using AI tokens. He's awesome. This is great. Some employees told Financial Times they had been using Meshclaw, an in-house agent platform that can initiate code deployments, triage emails, and interact with Slack to maximize their token numbers. Amazon said usage statistics would not factor into performance evaluations, but multiple employees said they believe managers were monitoring the data. One said there was so much pressure to use these tools. Another described how tracking created perverse incentives. Show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. The practice, dubbed token maxing, has become widespread enough to generate its own vocabulary and leaderboards. But beyond workplace culture, if a meaningful share of AI consumption is performative, meaning they're only doing it for show, how reliable are the demand figures that hundreds of billions of dollars in AI infrastructure procurement are being allocated against? The demand is insane. At least some of the demand is fake. Angie Jones, formerly the VP of Engineering for AI Tools at Block, told Lead Dev she expected the industry to pivot towards measuring efficient token usage rather than celebrating volume. In a cycle where GPU orders and power commitments are being placed years in advance, the quality of the demand projections behind them matters. The hyperscalers are building for a world where every knowledge worker consumes hundreds of thousands of dollars in annual compute. Whether that consumption proves productive or performative will determine how much of this year's $700 billion of CapEx actually generates durable returns. And I submit there won't be any return because I agree much of it is performative, artificially inflated, or just being sold at a loss. And if it's not sold at a loss, the price will rise so much that it's no longer a productivity-enhancing tool because it costs more than people just doing the work. Oh, and by the way, people are better at it than AI. But for now, Amazon employees are faking their AI usage to look better in front of the boss. And last but not least, I got to talk about this one that came out yesterday. Shown here, this is a clip from CoffeeZilla's YouTube channel exposing a $300 million Ponzi scheme. There's CoffeeZilla, one of my favorite channels on YouTube. Coffee does amazing work. But seated across from the table, some of you melonheads may recognize this guy seated across from him. That is Danny DeHeck, who is also known as the Crypto Ponzi Scheme Avenger. And you may recognize Danny because I've worked with Danny in the past. I did a couple of live streams with him. It was about 2 years ago, shortly after I unmasked the fake CEO, Stephen Reese Lewis from Hyperverse, who was actually, what was his name? Steve Harrison, a guy, some drunk hiding in Bangladesh or wherever he was, Bangkok. By the way, Stephen Harrison, a.k.a. Stephen Reese Lewis, was never held to account. Law enforcement never even interviewed the guy. He just got away with being a fake CEO of a billion-dollar front company. But Danny DeHeck was one of the guys back then that was leading the charge against the Hyperverse scam. And that's how I got to know Danny when I unmasked the CEO. And he has kept at it. And Danny started following a company called Goliath Ventures that Danny swore up and down was a Ponzi scheme on his channel. Goliath Ventures sued him. And, you know, when you get sued, guys, your life flashes before your eyes. Danny went through hell following this story. Well, the CEO of Goliath Ventures was recently indicted for running a Ponzi scheme because they actually proved it. And Danny led the charge against this company. So it's really good to see Danny getting recognition on a channel as big as CoffeeZilla. He's got 4.5 million subscribers on that channel. Job well done, Danny. Bravo, sir. Thank you for what you do. By the way, guys, Danny has his own channel. If you just search DeHeck, as in what DeHeck, D-E-H-E-K, This is Danny's channel here. I highly recommend you subscribe to that. And be sure to tell him that nobody sent you. This is the golden age of fraud. It is everywhere. I can tell you there's not a lot of money in this work. Exposing fraud is not nearly as lucrative as doing fraud. And a lot of people are getting away with it, buying themselves presidential pardons. Danny DeHeck is one of the few guys who is holding the line. He's one of the good guys here. So head over to Danny's channel. Give him an attaboy. Tell him nobody sent you. Danny, bravo, sir. You are a gentleman and a scholar and a freaking warrior for decency. So good job, Danny. All right. I just want to say, guys, thank you very much for having your coffee with the Melon Heads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button, should you feel so inclined. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melon Heads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. Links are down there in the description. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.